Valentine's Day, for the most part, is a day spent with the ones you love. But that wasn't the case for Nathan Luthold and his wife, Denise. I'm Felicia Huffman, and this is Macabre at Midnight. It's Valentine's Day.
Whoopee.
So we're... and my mom's with us. So today's episode is Valentine's themed.
Yay. Sorry. Valentine's Day is one of those days that just makes me fatter because we get candy and I scarf it down and all that good stuff. So,
and I normally get another stuffed animal from my bed, which can't hold anymore. Actually, I think I've told you the past couple of years, just get me candy. I don't need any more stuffed animals.
Well, I mean, there for a while, we slacked off on the stuffed animals because you got into coffee cups or coffee mugs.
Yeah.
And we would buy you a coffee mug, and you're like, I don't have any more room for coffee mugs. So we went back to stuffed animals, and then, yeah, now I think we just get you some candy or something like that.
Actually, not counting Valentine's Day of 2020, but in 2019 Valentine's Day, I got myself a sloth tattoo, and the year prior you got me a sloth stuffed animal.
Yep. Yeah.
And I got a sloth squishmallow for Christmas.
Yeah.
I like sloths. The squishmallow's name is Kenneth. So while it's Valentine's themed, it's not going to be a happy story. If you came here looking for a happy Valentine's Day story, you're at the wrong podcast.
Yeah.
And obviously you've never listened before. So it's Valentine's Day, and as such, our story takes place on Valentine's Day. I'm sure we are all familiar with the infamous Valentine's Day massacre that took place in 1929 when seven members of Chicago's North Side Gang were killed at Lincoln Park Garage. The four unknown assailants lined them up against a wall and shot them. This led to a struggle to control the organized crime in the city between the Irish North Side's head by George Bugs Moran and the Italian South Side Gang headed by Al Capone. While nobody has ever found out who perpetrated the act, everybody believes Capone was to blame.
Well, of course.
We are also familiar with Oscar Pistorius and his Valentine's Day murder of his girlfriend, for which he is serving 13 years in prison. So I'd like to present to you another Valentine's Day murder. This murder also took place on February 14th, 2013, the same day as Pistorius murdered his girlfriend.
Oh, two murders on the same day.
Yeah, different countries, though.
Ah.
A former missionary, Nathan Luthold, was often described to be a good person, but that persona was ripped to shreds when he decided to kill his wife. Nathan and his wife, Denise, were very active in their Lithuanian-oriented church, and before they had children, they would travel the world doing missionary work. They also brought Lithuanian women who had escaped abusive relationships to the U.S. to help them live a better life. The day began just like any other. They had their Valentine's tradition. That morning, Nathan woke the kids up and got them bathed and ready while Denise made breakfast for the family. After they were ready, the kids were allowed to enjoy a Valentine's treat, and Nathan surprised Denise with chocolates and flowers waiting on the table before they sat down for breakfast.
Aww.
After breakfast, the kids were taken to school, and Nathan headed to church while Denise stayed home. But in 2013, things went awry. Nathan didn't go to the church. While it has never been shared what exactly Nathan did that day leading up to the major events, here's what we have learned. He drove Denise's car to a park where, as he told the police, he often visited, and tossed the keys into a trash can. He returned home after he knew that everybody except his wife would be gone for the day and killed her. He ransacked the house, even taking things out of the house, including two guns, and broke one of the windows to make it look as if somebody had broken in. He opened the garage door and left. We don't know where he went, though.
I hope when he broke the window, he broke it from the outside to actually make it look like, because if you're breaking in from the outside, the glass is going to be inside and not outside, so that's a lot of mistake a lot of people make. Just my two cents there.
Later on, Janelle's daycare called Nathan to tell him Denise had not come to pick her up. Nathan then phoned his in-laws to see if they had heard from Denise, and they told him that she hadn't answered her phone and offered to pick up Janelle. Nathan said he could do it, he picked up Janelle and went to their home to, quote, check on Denise. This was when he called 911. It was around 3:15 when he calmly called the police as soon as he got to the house. His daughter stated that it looked like somebody had broken in. He said that a window had been broken and the garage door was left open. He told them that he wouldn't go inside. At no point during the 911 call did he voice concern about his wife. Once police arrived and secured the property, Nathan went inside, but only went to the areas where his wife's body was not. Police at first believed that there had been a robbery because electronics had been removed and how everything had been thrown about. This was when Nathan told them that he owned three guns, two of which were missing, a .22 caliber Beretta and a .40 caliber Glock, the same gun that had killed his wife. During their investigation, the police decided to look into the trunk of Nathan's car. This was likely after they had discovered the body and started to suspect that he might have been involved. Inside, they discovered foreign currency, different security box keys, and multiple fake passports.
Okay.
After they checked his phone, they found that he had been texting a woman named Anya about being robbed, and she had responded with, "interesting," smiley emoji. That served as enough evidence to bring Nathan in for questioning. Once they had him in the interrogation room, they told him that his wife had been killed by a gunshot to the head. Nathan didn't even try to feign interest in this news, nor was he the least bit surprised. After a 6-hour-long interrogation, Nathan was charged with first-degree murder. Let's back up for a second. Who is Anya? Nathan had met Anya while he and his family were on a missionary work in Lithuania. Anya and her mother were heavily involved with the church, and Anya often helped out with the Luthold children. When they were to return to the States, the Luthholds sponsored Anya as an exchange student interested in music and ministry work. Luthold soon became obsessed with the young woman and had an extended relationship with her. They used the emails he had sent to her as evidence in the prosecution of the case. The trial lasted 6 days and had more than 40 witnesses.
Wow.
It seems as though the interrogation is what really sold the police on the fact that Nathan killed his wife. Let's take a moment and learn a bit about the psychology of language. In these interviews, they assume that the speaker is, quote, de facto innocent, and that he shares information to be understood. This means that they expect a reliable denial, and that they don't expect to notice any language characteristic that indicates that what he is saying isn't true. In the case of Nathan Luthold, they expected him to say, "I didn't kill my wife Denise," and not him repeating what the interviewer said to him. They also want to see the wall of truth. This is a psychological barrier that leads an innocent person to use very few words, as they don't have the needs to persuade a person to think a certain way. Reliable denial is found in the free editing process and not repeated language, and is made up of three parts. The first is the pronoun I. The second is the past tense verb did not or didn't. The third is accusation answered. A person who is trying to deceive somebody will alter their denial to avoid a direct lie. Any combination of "I didn't kill my wife, Denise," "I told the truth, I'm innocent," is considered to be reliable denial and 99% likely to be a truthful statement. Every analysis starts out with the expectation of truth, and it is unexpected statements that show possible deception. After his trial, Nathan spoke to Dateline NBC correspondent Andrea Canning about what happened prior to his 911 call. He said, quote, "My parents called me. You want us to pick her up. I said Denise should be there any minute. She must have been late. She hadn't answered her phone calls. She hadn't answered her text messages. I said, just wait a few minutes. Let me get Janelle at the daycare. Then I'll let you know. And I finally got to the daycare. They said, she hasn't come, she hasn't called. I said, well, I'll drop by the house and see if she's there. And as soon as I pulled into the driveway, the garage door was open. I can see the window pane was broken and the glasses on the ground. At that point, I began to put things together and someone had broken into the home. And then at that point, I called the police, called 911.
See, he didn't break the glass. He wouldn't have seen the glass. The glass would not have been on the ground. He should have broken the glass. See, that's what people make the mistake. The glass has got to be broken from the outside if you're going to fake a robbery.
Because it would make absolutely no sense if the garage door was open and they got in that way and then broke a window to get out. Like, the garage door is still open.
Yeah. Unless some garages have, like, if I had a garage... and I had a door that connected into the house, I would make sure that door was locked. So they would have either had to have broken that door down to get into the house, or that really doesn't make sense that the garage door would be open and then... Yeah. But yeah, you gotta think it through, people. Think it through.
After he called 911, the operator asked, "What's the problem?" He responded with, "We had a break-in." Is something we say when we pause to think. This pause tells us that the question, "What's the problem?" is sensitive to him. The order a person speaks shows their priority and subjects. Nathan showed that the break-in was more important than his wife, since he didn't mention her. This is unexpected, since Denise had not been answering her calls or texts, and he told Andrea Canning that he returned home to check on his wife. The operator then said, "Is it going on right now?" To which he replied, "I don't know. The garage door's open. There's glass from the back door. Somebody broke in. I'm not going into the house yet." Again, he does not mention Denise. Nathan knew that Denise stayed home and that she was at risk, but chose not to go inside or mention her. He only shared information on the phone call to 911 that supported the idea of a break-in. The "I" before the garage door statement is a broken sentence. It shows self-censoring, which means he is deliberately withholding information. He started to place himself into the sentence, but stopped whatever he was getting ready to say. Let's go over some things he said in his actual interrogation. The interrogation took place between 6 p.m. on the 14th to 12:30 a.m. on the 15th. Nathan said, quote, "I'm trying to not think about nothing but the kids, about nothing but the ministry. What we do, everything is so tight together as a family. One thing, it's all a house of cards. She is the main one to hold it all together, and I'm trying to shut off the thoughts that happens. What happened with this? I can't go to Europe and hold the kids by myself and be full-time, so everything, I'm trying to hold that off. I want to get this done. I don't want any more long agencies. I want to get this done. I'm trying not to get upset. I don't mean mad. I mean upset." End quote. Nathan shows that his priority is to be the good guy, because he most definitely is not. He is also self-focused. He shows no pain for the death of his wife, but talks about the repercussion of her death. He tries to take control over the interview and shows some unexpected verbal aggressiveness. Plus, Nathan never refers to his wife, Denise, as "my wife Denise" or "my wife" or "Denise," but only as "she." Providing a social introduction would show they had a good relationship, but his words show they had a poor relationship. At one point, Nathan said, quote, "I don't want to say something that would be misconstrued. I don't like all these rights warnings." End quote. A reliable denial is hard to misinterpret. An innocent person only thinks to be misconstrued when he has wrongfully been accused, not before the interview. When he said this, he is likely talking more to himself than the detectives. This shows that he was on guard. He also said, "You can't tell me things about her. You can't tell me the things about her." So he is trying to control the interview. The detective said, "I'm telling you she is dead." Nathan replied, "You told me." He didn't express any emotions when he was told Denise was dead. That's why the detective said it again. But Nathan gave yet another cold answer. The detective asks, "Was there anything of extreme value?" Nathan replied with, in the house?" The detective replies, "In your room, in that room in particular." To which he replied, I had, two watches, a couple $100 watches, nothing." His first reply with a question was to buy time. His stuttering with the word "I" shows that there is a lot of anxiety, considering humans are extremely efficient at using this pronoun. The detective asks, "Do you know why anybody would want to break in there?" Nathan replied, "I have been trying to ask the same question since I pulled in the driveway." Most people would have worded the statement as, "I have been trying to answer that question since I pulled in the driveway." The way he worded it is deceptive. When he gets asked about how Denise's car got to Robinson Park, all Nathan can say is, The detective says, "I'm just trying to figure out how many sets of keys are out there because I'm trying to find a set of keys." Nathan replies, "I know there is one set of keys, and whenever I have borrowed, whenever I got the car to go get something fixed on it, I just ask her for the keys and she gives me the keys, or she says they are on the plate." When Nathan said, "I know there is one set of keys," he is telling the truth, but he doesn't exclude that he knows that there are actually two sets of keys. If he said, "I know there is only one set of keys," then that would mean there was only one set of keys. It's like saying, "I had two glasses of wine, officer," which is the truth, because the person who had five glasses of wine had definitely drunk two before the others. There is a lot more to that interview, but we haven't got 6 hours to go over it. So let's move on to some other statements he made. Nathan chose not to testify during his trial, but as mentioned before, he did speak to Dateline NBC correspondent Andrea Canning after he was sentenced. This is where he really shows his manipulative and self-centeredness. Nathan said, quote, "I was in third grade, and she was in fourth grade at the time, and I doubt she even knew I existed, but even then, I thought she was the cutest girl in the school." Nathan shows he is a narcissist. He gives us a bit of a glimpse into his personality disorder when he says that even she didn't know he existed, he thought that she was the cutest girl. He later said, "I looked at Denise's mom at the time and saw that she was a woman, as a wife, as a mother, and I saw that Denise really favored her mother, and so I said that's what I want." His idea of a relationship is that's what I want, is extra evidence that he is a narcissist. He chose Denise in order to fill his needs and to enhance his idea of a perfect image.
Okay, that bugs me. For the fact, he thought Denise was cute in school.
Uh-huh.
And I guess as they got older, they began dating. And then when he's looking at Denise's mother, comparing her to her mother, and seeing what she's going to look like as she gets older.
Uh-huh.
And of course, like they said, that shows narcissistic tendencies. He couldn't choose her for who she was inside, but what she looked like and how she would look on his arm is the way I get it. Yeah. And how she's going to look as she ages.
Yeah, I mean, like, when he saw her when they were kids, he said that she's cute, but the main thing I feel that drew her to him is that he didn't think she knew he was alive, so that became a chase for him.
Yeah, it became a challenge.
When he sees that her mother is like the ideal person,
yeah,
he's like, well, this is going to look good for my image.
Yeah,
because I know when I was doing this and I was writing those things down, I'm thinking some of that just seems innocent. Like, it seems like anybody would be like, "Oh, I noticed her when we were in kindergarten, she was so cute," or whatever. But when you start to think of the language, like breaking down the language and the small subtleness of his statements,
mm-hmm.
That's where it gets creepy.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I'm sure there are people out there who have met when they were in grade school or whatever, but the person didn't like them because they didn't notice them.
Yeah.
They liked them because they liked them.
Yeah. I mean, that's like that, the old expression, love at first sight. I mean, you see somebody and there's just an automatic connection. You know. To me, he didn't have that connection.
He saw her as a challenge.
Yeah, he saw her as a challenge and as a trophy. And especially after he saw that her mom was like the perfect housewife or whatever, he's like, ooh, she would have those tendencies because her mother is like this, so her mother has taught her to do this and that and the other. So that's going to look good on me.
Yep.
Okay.
In the rest of his interview with Dateline, he uses first-person words like "I" and "me" a lot. This helps prove that he has narcissistic tendencies. To add to that, he would use phrases like, "My world has just been shattered," or how do I know how to function? When he recalled memories from the day of her murder, he would use present tense such as, I am looking for my 4-year-old daughter. People who are remembering something they experienced will use past tense. When asked why he didn't take the stand, he replied, quote, I had chosen to testify prior to trial, but as the state continued to take things out of context and continue to throw as much mud as they could on the wall and hoping that some of it would stick, they had moved beyond what I felt were the facts of the case. I wasn't going to give them any more fuel or any more fodder to use or to misconstrue, but things were stolen, insurance claims verified they were stolen and paid the claim. It was a burglary. Did it look like a normal burglary? I'm not sure what a normal burglary looks like. God, I don't typically get political, but that statement, it didn't even click when I first wrote it down, but it gives me flashbacks to the crap Trump would say after he lost the election.
Yeah. Yeah.
When a murderer stages a burglary, they will typically take things to make it look believable. Nathan says that he doesn't know what a normal burglary looks like. It is not up to him to recognize a staged burglary from a real one, and they could tell that from how he staged the house. While the word narcissistic gets thrown around a lot, it seems that Nathan holds all of the common signs and symptoms of NPD. He did not show any emotion during all of this, even the day of the murder when he was told his wife was dead. During the trial, the video shows he is very emotionless, and even the statement of a fellow missionary proves that this emotionless persona wasn't something new. William Harper said, quote, he was a very logical person and very much in control of his emotions. It was rare to see him do anything emotional. That's one thing that points to him because he was such an organized person. And when I found out they spent the night together in an apartment, that's when I thought he could be guilty. He came back for a week or so for the funeral and spent a lot of time with him during that. That was the only time I have ever seen him cry. He talked a lot about the children and about how they were going to miss their mother, especially the girls, who were looking forward to doing things with the niece. I remember him talking a lot about how it would affect his work, how it was going to affect the children, but I don't remember him saying anything along the lines that he was going to miss his wife. End quote. Luthold didn't show emotions because he lacked empathy, which is a quintessential hallmark of people with narcissistic personality disorder. While Nathan didn't take the stand, Anya did. She claimed the two were not lovers and called him her mentor and employer. During her time on the stand, she started out talking through a translator, which she got frustrated with, but by the end, she was speaking English without a problem. Nathan met Anya when she was 6, and then brought her to the U.S. when she was 18. She said of her relationship with Nathan that he paid her expenses, took her on trips to Europe, went shooting, and exercised together, but she claimed they never stayed overnight with each other. She also said that Denise never went with them when they did things together. Anya claimed it was because Denise couldn't talk in Lithuanian, but that was disproven because Denise went on a mission trip to Lithuania and did speak the language. They would go to the spa together. In fact, Nathan, Denise, and Anya went to the spa a lot, but the spa attendant didn't even know that Nathan was married to Denise because he was at the spa with Anya more. David D. Smith, an inmate who had been serving a 14-year sentence for drug conviction, told jurors that Nathan had said he had waited in the closet for his wife, then shot her once in the head. He said Nathan had approached him within a few weeks of arriving at Peoria Jail in March and sought his advice. When all was said and done, the jury deliberated for only 90 minutes and returned with a guilty verdict for first-degree murder. Judge Kevin Lyons offered a gut-wrenching speech before rendering his sentence. Quote, I have to give you credit. You have led a law-abiding life for many years. You did good things, but you have poisoned it all. End quote. He went on to say that it was shameful that he killed his wife in her parents' home, a place that she and her kids had considered a happy place. He also called him a thief for taking Denise away from her children and family. The worst thing I think about this whole thing is that the murder of his wife got labeled as a Valentine's Day present for Anya. It was extremely well planned, as was seen by the internet searches for how to silence a 40 caliber Glock. Attorney Jerry Brady alleged that Luthold was a cold-blooded killer who blew his wife's head off, staged a fake break-in, and went about his day ensuring that he was caught on camera everywhere he went to create an alibi. Toner, Nathan's attorney, said that his client didn't have a prior criminal record and should only be given the minimum sentence of 45 years, since basically any sentence would become a life term, because in Illinois, a person has to serve 100% of any prison term for murder. Toner then claimed that they had no proof that Anya and Luthold had a romantic relationship, to which Judge Lyons spat, "Really?" A rather unexpected outburst from a judge. Lyons ended the sentence by saying, quote, "You will end your life in a cold and gray, isolated Illinois penitentiary where you will be more of a number than a name. You'll be leaving this country to become more of a nobody and less of a somebody," end quote. He then gave him an 80-year sentence. There is one last thing I want to share from this case. If what we have gone over didn't convince you that Nathan deserved the sentence he got, here is a letter that Denise had written to Nathan that the detectives found in their bedroom. "What on earth could you possibly be thinking? I can't imagine anything you could tell me that would hurt worse than what you are doing to me now, every day. I really don't think there's anything that I have done or not done that would cause me to deserve this. I have tried to please you for 17 years and never succeeded. I've never been good enough, never done enough. I know that you want me dead. I'm not stupid. I suppose it will confirm my worthlessness to you when I write that I'm not brave enough to do that job for you. And now, all of a sudden, you are taking me with you places? What is that all about? Maybe you think I don't feel bad enough. You act like you are somehow noble because you won't tell me why you are doing this. It makes me sick. I have been willing at any time to fall in love with you again, but you reject me every time. I wish I could hate you. I've tried to hate you because I thought it would make it easier. I thought it wouldn't hurt so bad. Of course I couldn't do it, so I failed at that too. I have been without pride. I have humiliated myself to try to win something that belongs to me. You defraud me, and you don't seem to care. Well, I quit. I'm not going to try to please you anymore. I will do what I have done, but no more of that game. You want to humiliate me by running around with a 20-year-old? Fine, I won't grovel. If I haven't pleased you in 17 years, nothing I do will please you. I refuse to leave my children just because you have decided to do this to me. You are the only person who thinks I'm a bad mother. Complete strangers compliment me on them, so I will not join you in your obsession with perfection. I am the same person that I've always been. I'm not weaker and in many ways stronger. I refuse to play to your perfectionism in that, too. I have borne neglect and criticism and kept going. But now this? How long? How long are you going to do this to me? Oh, yeah, until I break. That's what you said, isn't it? Well, happy waiting." Your thoughts?
Just when you think you know a person and you think you've hid things from them, the shit hits the fan. I mean, did he find the note or did the detectives find the note?
I mean, the detectives found the note, but I don't know if he had already read the note prior to what had happened. We don't know when that note was written.
Oh, okay. Narcissists have that, they think they can, quote, pull the wool over your eyes and get away with all their betrayals, but they always seem to slip up in the end. And it's one of those things, if he thought he was sneaking around and had hid it from her and she figured it out, he, you know, and then she, you know, leaves that, you know, the whole town knew what he was doing.
And, possibly.
Well, the spa person said that he came to the spa with Anya more than he did with his wife.
Yeah.
I mean, for her to be able to go out
and even hold her head up, knowing the whole town probably knew what was going on, so-called behind her back. She was the strongest woman in the world.
Yep. I mean, there's a good chance that that note was probably what set him over the edge.
Probably.
Realizing that the only way he was going to be able to get out of that relationship with her and be with Anya was to kill her. Because while you could tell in her note that he had beaten her down, and she did, she was feeling the effects of having been in a relationship with a narcissist, she was very strong-willed.
Yeah.
She wasn't willing to leave her children. And she knew inside of her she was a good mother, even though he had done his best to try to make her feel like she wasn't.
Yeah.
I feel like I lost my train of thought there.
Well, I mean, even in the notes, she said that the community had, you know, she had met people in the community, probably at the park and stuff with other parents. And, you know, she might have even mentioned to one of them that she didn't feel like she was a good mother or a good parent or whatever. And they're like, no, you're a great mother or whatever. And they had reconfirmed that within her and everything. And she just, you know, she wasn't. Although, like you said, he had beat her down. He had probably, well, you know how narcissists do.
The one thing he didn't do that most narcissists do is separate her from others. And I think that's mainly because he had to keep up that prominent role in the church. So he couldn't very well prevent her from going out and everything. She was a stay-at-home mom, so I guess in a sense he did try to separate her from other people, but he didn't control her to the point where
she
couldn't do and go places.
Right.
That's the one thing, and I think that might have been why she didn't get as, I guess, depressed as some victims of narcissism do, is because she did have some people who were like, no, you're great. And they were living at her parents' place. Like, her parents didn't live with them. I guess they were, like, renting or maybe just living there for free or whatever.
Yeah.
Which I think it's interesting that he referred to his in-laws as his parents in the Dateline interview, when everywhere else it was his in-laws that called and asked if they needed to go pick up Janelle, since Denise wasn't answering her calls and everything.
Right. But yeah, I would just like to know how, with that note, how soon before Valentine's Day she had wrote it, or how, and how old was he, by the way? Because I know she mentioned something about running around with a 20-year-old.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, how much older was he than her?
He was 41 in 2016, so.
Okay. So, yeah, about half his age.
And the sick thing is he met her when she was six.
He did, and yeah, when you said that thought popped in my head, because, you know, he made the comment when they were in school that she was cute. Did he have those same feelings? Did he think of Anya as being cute, and then she became his next challenge? And he watched her grow up, and he conditioned her to be the what he wanted her to be.
I think that's the thing, is he probably, I mean, I don't know. He might not have had that. Maybe he doesn't, because to me, let's finish a whole sentence here. They don't specify when the relationship became sexual. Maybe when he met her when she was six, it was nothing more than wanting to help out. Or, to be fair, he's never wanted to help out somebody else. He's just wanting to help his image. That's why he did the things he did do.
Yep.
It could have been completely innocent other than to satisfy his ego. And then once she came to the U.S. at the age of 18, because we don't know how many times he actually saw her in person between 6 and 18. Maybe it was just written correspondences or whatever. And then when he sees her when she's 18, that's when he's like, oh, pretty, must make mine. I don't know. Because he would be, in my eyes, considered a pedophile if, while she's 6 years old, he's going, yes, she will be mine. I'm going to groom her for her to be perfect for me. It might not have been until she came to the States at the age of 18 that he decided, I like her, I want her.
Well, I mean, and if he did start the relationship as soon as she came to the United States, that relationship had been going on for at least 2 years.
Yes.
Before his wife.
Before he killed his
wife. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And see, to me, that just, I still, it's one of those, did he, you know, know? I mean, that's going to bug me, and I know I'll let it go eventually, but I know within that it doesn't say anything about, I mean, he met her at 6 and then he brought her to the United States, but within that time, how many times did he see her, and did he have that thought of, she will be mine?
Yeah.
And if he did, ick.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just one sick bastard. I mean, I'm sorry. It's just...
And I just wonder if Anya denying that they had a relationship, if that was the truth or not. Like, did she say that because he told her to make him look more innocent? Or did she honestly believe that their relationship was innocent and that maybe they didn't have sex? And she thought he was just being a nice guy and doing these things for her to help make her life in the U.S. easier. And she was just naive.
Honestly, it could be that. She was just naive. I mean, being from a different country. And then this guy brings her over here. And
a God-fearing man, assuming.
Yeah. And he's just trying to help her. Because I think she even mentioned, called him her employer.
Yeah.
So maybe in her eyes, that was what American men did. They, you know, just to help out a person from a different country, they would, you know, give them a job and help them out. And maybe all their time spent together in her eyes was just, helping her learn American ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, but I mean, it is feasible. I don't know the customs of Lithuania, but yeah, it could be that in her mind, they weren't having what we consider an affair. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, that's very well possible because he could have told her that, like, maybe she asked, well, why doesn't Denise go with us? And that's when he's like, well, she doesn't speak Lithuanian. So, you know, he just lied to her about that, and that's why she was just repeating what she had been informed. And then they're like, Denise does speak Lithuanian. That's a lie.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, you take even an 18-year-old, like I said, from a different country, not knowing the American ways, you know, and then you've got this, like you said, a God-fearing man, you know, conditioning you, teaching you, you know, and all this. He probably made her feel really special, and that's what narcissists do at the beginning. They make you feel super special.
Yep.
And that's what, you know, she probably felt that way. And, you know, in her eyes, he was, you know, I don't know the word I'm looking for there, but I mean, even he, you know, he had told her, you work for me, I guess, do as I say, you know, and we'll just make sure you're, I don't know. But yeah, I don't think she actually, I don't think she perjured herself as so much as she just really didn't know him. And she, like you said, she was just repeating what he had said.
Yeah. I mean, there was other text messages between them as well as email correspondences that I didn't get into because it would make this very long-winded, that could imply that maybe she did know more than what she let on. I don't know, but I feel that she was a little bit on the naive side, and that anything that other Americans would have been like, well, obviously you're having an affair, he just took advantage of the fact that she's not American, she wasn't born American and everything, she's not used to the American customs, and taking advantage of her naivety.
Right.
But he still maintains his innocence.
Well, of course he is. That's what narcissists do. They never do anything wrong. But yeah, I mean, to me, finding the note from the wife, that just clinched it. And
oh yeah,
I mean, even if they hadn't been having sex, if he had a tendency to stay overnight elsewhere, I just want to know what he did to slip up to where the wife found out.
Well, I know, I think it was, well, now that couldn't be possible. But anywho, there was at some point that it was said that Nathan spent the night in a hotel room or apartment or something with Anya.
Uh-huh.
And even one of his fellow parishioners had found that out. I don't know when that happened. Because at first I thought that's where he went the night after they found, after he murdered his wife. But right. That couldn't be possible because he spent that night in jail
right.
with the interrogation. And then he got charged. And I mean, I guess he could have bonded out and then went and spent the night with her. Because you don't technically have to stay in jail until your trial if you can bail yourself out.
If the judge sets bail. Judge has that.
They have the authority where if you're a flat risk or whatever, they don't have to give you bail.
Yep.
But I'm guessing he probably did because he had a clean record.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of stupid on his part. If he had read that letter, why didn't he dispose of it? Because that's a big red flag.
Oh, yeah.
And if he couldn't see that, if he was that narcissistic, it's like, oh, they're going to read that letter and not believe it. They're going to believe me because I'm a good guy. And maybe that's the thing. Maybe that's why he didn't get rid of it.
Yeah.
Maybe he was trying to play the victim and be like, see how she thought about me?
Yeah. Possibly. Yeah.
I also wonder who got custody of the kids. I'm hoping it was Denise's parents.
Well, nothing was really said about his parents. The only thing I was, you know, because I'm pretty sure they lived in Denise's parents' house.
Yeah.
So, I would think so.
I worry about the kids.
Oh, yeah.
Janelle was in daycare, so she was probably young enough to where it might not have as big of an effect on her. I mean, I know even young children can have things that happen to them even before their earliest memories can have a lasting effect on them. But I'm hoping since she was so young that it doesn't. The other two were on the older side. I know one of them would be up in his mid-teens by now. I mean, it just happened in 2013. It's not that too terribly long ago. Almost 10 years. So that was a while ago. But yeah, that's what I worry about is the impact it had on the kids. And I also worry like the fact that they had a narcissistic father as to how much his narcissism had already hurt them mentally.
Yeah.
But hopefully they could get help and not fall into
his
footsteps.
If the grandparents raised them, hopefully they got them some help. I know, not knowing exactly how old Janelle was, I know... I can still remember the day my great uncle Ab died. I was 4. So yeah, if she was younger than that, she probably won't remember it. And then while you was reading that, I'm thinking, oh dear God, don't let him take her in the house to find her mother.
Yeah.
That was my big thing. I was like, oh Lord, don't let her see her dead mother.
Well, yeah. I know she's probably got to be younger than 5 because she was in daycare and not in regular school like her siblings were.
And most daycares go until the age of 5 or they start kindergarten, whichever happens first. I would hope they got... I mean, I don't... Were they all girls? Were they mixture?
There was 2 girls and 1 boy.
The boy would be the one I would worry about... developing the narcissistic tendencies. Why is it that men have a tendency to be more, or to me it seems like the men in my life have always been more narcissistic. I know my mother is, but side note, but yeah, seems like most of the men I've encountered, I can see more narcissistic tendencies in them than the females in my life.
Everybody can have a little bit of narcissism. It doesn't necessarily mean they have a narcissistic personality disorder. You can be narcissistic at times, and a little bit of narcissism is just a healthy ego. But yeah, I don't know why it seems to be that men tend to be the more narcissistic type. And I don't know the statistics, if there's an equal of actual NPD cases, as if more men have it than women. I don't know. But I do know from some of the books that we've written and stuff like that, that a person becomes narcissistic because of the way of the household they were raised in. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, you're not born with like narcissistic personality disorder. You're either raised by a narcissist or you're raised by a codependent person. And typically, if the person is codependent, then their other mate is narcissistic or has some other type of mental illness. You've been neglected in some way and your mind copes with it, and either you becoming narcissistic or you becoming codependent.
Right.
And that's why I said I hope the kids get help so that they don't fall into the trap of either one of those.
Well, let's hope they did. And let's hope they grow up to be fine, upstanding human beings.
Better than their father.
Better than their father. Hopefully they take after their mother.
Yeah. She was strong.
Yes.
But I'm sure Valentine's Day will not be a special day for them ever.
No.
Any partner they have be like, we don't care. Yeah. We're not going to celebrate this day. It's just a day.
Valentine's Day does not exist. And honestly, I know a lot of people say that some of these holidays, and yeah, it does make you wonder. I know Valentine's Day was done to celebrate the patron saint. I don't know, the Saint Valentine. I'm not sure. I guess he was the patron saint of love or something or another. But well, I know a lot of people.
There's a history of it. I'm not sure.
There's a lot of people that say it's just candy companies and card companies have really commercialized a lot of the holidays that were.
To me, St. Patrick's Day and St. Valentine's Day are basically just an excuse for Americans to drink and eat candy.
Well, Valentine's Day, champagne, yeah, I guess you could do that. But yeah, St. Patrick's Day, it's just a drink. It's a beer fest.
A lot of those holidays have nothing to do with Americans or American Mm-mm. traditions. They come from different countries, and we're just like, we're going to piggyback on it and make it Americanized and drink green beer. While the Irish is sitting back going, seriously. Because, like half of us, we don't even know why it's a holiday to begin with. Yep. All right. Any other thoughts about the prick, Nathan Luthold? I think this is, I don't know, a lot of the murder cases we've done I get upset about, but this one, I guess I'm more upset because it's been recent and that he did it on Valentine's Day.
Yeah. I mean, I think he got what he deserved. I mean, I don't know, death penalty might have been better.
No, I think life in prison for him is worse because he's got to
sit there and
he's stuck trying to make himself perfect again, knowing he can't make himself perfect again.
Right. I think what also clinched it was I'm pretty sure the prosecutor had didn't you say that his jail cellmate testified that he had told him that he waited in the closet for her to come into the bedroom or whatever?
Yeah.
Is that where he killed her, was in the bedroom?
Yep. Yeah, there was an inmate that when he was taken into custody after he got charged with it. So obviously he might not have bailed out right away or something, or I don't know. But he spent some time in jail after he got charged, and there was a guy that he instantly just, made friends with that was serving a 14-year sentence for drugs and everything, and he confided in him, and then the prosecutor or whatever got wind of it, offered him a reduced sentence to, you know, share what happened.
Heck
yeah. And I'm sure that ticked Nathan off to no end, because him being a narcissist, he's thinking, you know, everybody loves me, and then somebody turns against him, and he's like,
he's in jail, nobody else is going to find out what, you know.
Yeah. And then his defense attorney's like, don't give him any more than 45 years because any sentence is going to be a death penalty for him because, you know, he's old. And in Illinois, if it's a murder conviction, you have to serve 100%. There's no chance of getting out early.
He was only 41 when he was sentenced. He would have been 86.
Yeah.
When he got out. He could still been alive.
Possibly, but he couldn't have done anything.
No. But, I mean, still.
But now, if he lives 100% of his 80 years, he'll be...
120?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, 121. Wow. Sorry. Anywho, but yeah, I think he got what he deserved.
Yeah. And I think what really screwed him over more than the fact he murdered his wife was the fact that he had lived his life as this God-fearing, upstanding citizen that was very active in his church and did missionary work and all this goody-goody stuff.
Yep.
And then he kills his wife to be with another woman. Like, that's worse. Like, if you're just a butt your entire life and you murder somebody, wrong, but yeah, we didn't expect anything less from him. But, you know, this guy, he was a great guy. It's like, no. So it just makes it worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it for tonight's episode. Make sure you check us out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Patreon. Stay spooky, everyone. See you next time.